There you go.
All right, I'm an addict named Brandon. Hi guys. It's an honor to be asked by the committee to come and speak. I had a million reasons why I could not be here. None of them were valid. So I'm here, and you know, God works in mysterious ways, and I'm just blessed to be here. So I guess I'll start out by giving you a little bit of a backstory of like where I came from and take you into the solution. I can tell you that like when I grew up, in a very strict religious family. My dad was a preacher at a church that was, you know, it was non-denominational, but it was very strict. There were a lot of guidelines and rules, and if you didn't follow those rules, you were going to hell. You know, so I grew up in that environment. Could not swear. Swearing, they believed in child rearing, you know, so I got the spoon, the boot, the shoe, the belt, the hand, whatever was available. And so that's kind of how we got our punishments. Timeouts didn't exist, you know, that was how we got taught. And I was the oldest, so I got it the most. I mean, I got it good. And my siblings, thank God, didn't follow my path. They were wise enough to kind of follow what not to do, you know. So, you know, growing up in that environment was difficult, man, because like society is not, well, we all know society's crazy. I mean, it's wild. And growing up and going to school, you know, there was kids watching, you know, I say it all the time, Simpsons, South Park was a thing. I remember one time I was at a sleepover and my parents somehow found out that I watched Blade, which is a fucking awesome movie, by the way. I watched Blade and they found out, and I couldn't have sleepovers for 2 years. 2 years, that was a punishment because I watched Blade. So there was like a lot of things, man, and like, you know, going through a fourth step, like kind of opened up, you know, a lot of forgotten, suppressed childhood memories, you know, because a lot of this stems from childhood. And, you know, I lived in a neighborhood with a lot of kids, and back then there was no like iPads and tablets and Game Boys and all that. Like, we went outside to play, and, you know, I got bullied a lot as a kid, man. Like, I got, I don't know how I suppressed it so far that I didn't realize that it happened until I wrote it down on paper. I got tied to a seesaw for 2 or 3 hours, and the kids were just going like this, like a concentration camp type shit, you know, like, you know, crazy, tied to a seesaw, just up and down, up and down. You know, there was a lot of instances where that happened as a kid. And, you know, so there was an anger and like a frustration as a child, and really no outlet because, you know, it was frowned upon to do anything. And, so I grew up in the church from the time I was born until the time I was 18, and when I turned 18, that was my last day going to church, right? So like, that was also when I moved out of the house. You know, I couldn't wait to get out because like I wanted to find out why, like for myself, why no was no and yes was yes, why it was black and white. Like, I didn't believe in that. I was like, there's no way, you know, that watching, you know, The Simpsons or South Park is gonna like send me to hell, you know, because that was my understanding, right? Like, this was a big one, tattoos. You can tell obviously I rebelled a little bit. It's you know, it's the temple of God, and you know, marking it is bad. And you know, the thing was, is like, my dad loved me completely and fully to his understanding. Like, he believed so hard in God, and when he said, and you know, as a kid, whenever he said, you know, I just don't want to see you go to hell. I was like, man, why are you saying that? Like that hurts. You know what I mean? Like you're thinking I'm going to go to hell. And really, looking back at it, it was how hard he believed that, like, when he went to heaven, like, he wanted me to be there. You know, he didn't want me to go down the path that I ultimately did, man. And like, so I got out, you know, I was 18, and you know, I was off to college, Penn State, and went to school there and found out that I really, really enjoy partying, probably like way more than I enjoy going to school. And so slowly over time, I became more of a partier and less of a scholar, I guess is what you would say. Eventually, I dropped out of college, and I continued to party. When I say party, I mean just, you know, drinking and smoking and doing things here and there. I found out at a young age that, like, a way to get attention would be to be funny and, like, over the top, which is ironic because I come in here and, like, I see my people that are just, you know, we're just over the top sometimes. And so, you know, I just kind of skated through my 20s, man. Like, there was really no rhyme or reason to it. I held down a job. I had a job for a good portion of that, man. And it got worse. Like, I went to a concert, right? And somebody gave me, we're gonna do all this. We're gonna, like, I'm into like heavy bands and shit. And we go to this show in Baltimore, and somebody said, well, let's take this Molly. And so, like, I did, and had a really, really, really bad time. I'm sitting there, you know, just listening to like the heaviest shit, which I'm normally into, but like, whenever you're having a really bad time, grinding your teeth to a pulp in a corner by yourself for hours, it's not a good time. And when I came back, for some reason, something, I was just like, all right, well, I think I'm done with that. And I quit drinking for 2 years. I quit doing everything for 2 years, just kind of holding on and doing the best I could. Some people call it white knuckle. I was just abstaining, that's it. And in that period of time, good things did start to happen. Like, I did get, you know, I got a promotion at a job. I became a little more trustworthy, a little more reliable, but I was still sick. Like, I was still sick. But I didn't know it. And that's the crazy thing about the disease, is like, sometimes you just don't know that you're stuck in a cycle of insanity, or, you know, acting on character defects. And like, I didn't even know what a character defect was in that period. But I did fuck around and find out. Excuse my language. I did come up here with the intention of trying not to swear, but like, it's, we'll get there someday. You know, I found out. So I got a tattoo done up underneath my armpit here, and it hurt. Like, don't get your armpit tattooed. It's just not a fun time. I did that, and it hurt, and it was swollen, and like, I could have taken a Tylenol, but I had a reservation. I thought, you know, well, my buddy has, you know, some Vicodin, maybe I'll just like take one of those. And mind you, I had been abstinent for 2 years. So I did, I got a Vicodin, and I took it, and I felt something other than myself for the first time in 2 years. And I was like, ah, there it is. There it is. And you know, it's crazy, because like, whenever you look at the literature, the one is too many, a thousand is never enough. You know, I didn't realize that. I didn't even know that literature existed. I didn't know that was a thing. But I took that one Vicodin, and it was progressive, man. Like, I was chasing that feeling. you know, at the time I had all the material things that you'd want, a house, a car, a motorcycle, a girl. So like on the outside things were great, but I was very unhappy. And so I took that Vicodin, and at the time I had a really good job at Best Buy as manager up in State College, and you know, I worked so hard to get there, and I was like very, you know, proud of myself for starting at the bottom and like working my way up, man. And like during this time, I'm taking more Vicodin, and one turns to two, and two turns to four turns to five, and you know, I don't realize that's unmanageable at the time because I have the money to spend on it, and so like I'm spending it, and eventually the Vicodins turns into Oxys, and then I'm taking two of those, and then three of those, then four of those, then five of those, then six of those, and I'm just taking handfuls by the day just to get through the day. And the one day I took too much, and I was closing shift. I had quite a few employees in the store, and I had to close it down, lock the door, make sure everything, alarm set, everything, make sure everybody's doing like what they need to do to close the store down. And this is about 3 or 4 hours before close, and my eyes are getting a little heavy. I'm like, I'm just gonna go back into like the office here. I'm gonna take just like a little nap. I'm gonna close the door and take just a little nap. That little nap became a really long nap, and I'm laying on the floor snoozing, like I'm out. And I wake up to them kicking in the door because I'm not responding and no one's heard from me. We have walkies in, and I was out. And so, you know, I went home and I was like, I knew that, like, I definitely fucked up. And the next day I went in and they asked me to resign, pretty much, like either that or, you know, get fired. And so I left there. I lost that. And you know, I had these grand plans. I was like, you know, this is not the end of the world, and I'm starting to do the blame thing. I'm like, well, they should have, like, you know, not kicked the door down and been so aggressive about it. I'm like, I just was, you know, taking a little bit of a nap, like it's not that big of a deal. And I, you know, here comes the justification and rationalization of the whole situation, which I didn't understand at the time either. I didn't even know I was doing it. Hindsight, I see that now. And so, like, I had this plan that, like, you know, I'm gonna have something else lined up. I'm gonna do something on the side that I was thinking about doing for a while, but now this is the opportunity I've been given to go do that. And that idea quickly fell apart because I was in the grips of the disease, in the grips of addiction, man, active addiction. And you know, just when you think it's gonna get like that, and so many times in active addiction, I was like, man, this is terrible. Like, it can't get any worse than this. And then, like, it did, like, it just did. The bitter ends, man. And again, I had no knowledge of the program. I had no recovery knowledge, but I did, again, fuck around and find out. Like, I quickly, the money ran out, right? Because that's what happens, and my savings is gone. My relationships are strained now because I'm caught up in the grips. I'm short. I break up with my girlfriend who I was with for a while. Slowly, well, the car doesn't get paid, right? I'm not paying the payment on the car. I'm not paying the payment on the bike. My thing's like, all right, well, the bike can go, so I can get this, and this, and I'll just make half payments on the car. And if I do that for 3 or 4 months, you know, I don't think they'll repo it because I'm making half, like, just made up shit in my mind. I'm like, you know, this will work. You know, things are cool. And, you know, ultimately, you know, you lose the bike. You're like, damn, I really like that thing. And then you go get high, and then it's not that big of a deal. But it is. It is. It's sitting there still. And then the car goes. So then your transportation, you can't go from point A to point B. It makes it a little bit harder to be an addict in active addiction. This disease is progressive, and it can be fatal. And I didn't realize the progression. I didn't understand the severity of it. I definitely didn't understand that it could be fatal, you know. And so, you know, I started doing the heavy shit. I started doing fentanyl. And somebody, I was around somebody who was around someone, and I'm sick, and I'm like, all right, well, let me try that, you know. And I was like, oh, this is the best thing ever. You know, why didn't I do this sooner? I think I literally said that one time. Why didn't I do this sooner? This is such a great thing. And, you know, it got worse, man. Like, I started to, in order to support this, I had to do things that I was, that I became willing to do, you know. My grandmother, who lived with my parents at the time, she had dementia, pretty advanced. They had to move her out of her home, and we moved her in, and it was, you know, tough for everyone, but not for me, because, like, I was not present. I was only present whenever I was in the house stealing out of her purse. Why she had massive amounts of cash in her purse is beyond me, but it didn't last very long, because I would sneak in and steal hundreds and hundreds, and I would take her card and link it to other bank accounts and steal thousands from my own grandmother, who loved me unconditionally from the time I was born. Even through the, she won't know. She has dementia. Like, she's not going to remember. But I didn't forget. Like, I didn't forget that. And it's crazy how far, like, this disease takes us, man. It takes us on a fucking ride, and, you know. Stealing money from her, homelessness is a part of my story. There becomes a certain point when no one trusts you. Like, my family kicked me out very early into active addiction. They were like, I don't want you around, we don't want you at functions, we don't want to see you. And I couldn't understand that. I'm like, they hate me because they think I'm the devil and I'm gonna, you know, corrupt the, you know, the family. And that's the way I viewed it then in active addiction. And I developed an anger and a hate for my mother and for my father in active addiction. And so I wasn't allowed around. I remember one time I was homeless, and I would communicate with my dad, and, like, this just kind of shines some light on unconditional love and how I view it now. My father, like, he loved me so deeply. I would, in active addiction, when I'm homeless, I would play, like, it's cold outside, I don't have a sleeping bag, like, I don't have anywhere to go, we're supposed to get snow tonight, and I would pour it on, because I knew if I poured it on enough, my dad would, like, open the door to me. You know, I took advantage of his love. Now, mind you, my mom would not let me in the house. It was set in stone. Do not let him in the house. And because my dad loved me so hard, and he didn't know how else to help me. His love was to help, you know. And he would sneak me into the house late at night and tell me that I had to be out before my mom woke up. I had to be out early in the morning so she didn't know. Now, mind you, this goes against everything my dad stands for. He was a very honest man. And to lie to his wife in order to keep his son from freezing, you know, it was always, I always made it out to be worse than what it actually was. Being homeless is terrible. It is terrible. You know, but I came, I, you know, he would let me in the house, and, you know, it continues, right? Like, it gets worse and worse and worse, and the overdoses start to come, you know. I was like, man, I can't believe I haven't overdosed yet. I must be, like, good. Like, I must be all right. And then the overdoses start coming, man. And they're rapid fire. Like, once you get going, it's hard to stop. And, you know, I remember there was a couple times, but I'll just share the one time that was... that really stands out in active addiction as part of my process coming into this program is, you know, I had overdosed. I was in a house full of people, and when I came back to, like, whenever, I don't know if you've ever had an overdose, but like when you have an overdose, for me, it's like I was being respawned into a video game. It's like, oh, here we are. What happened? Where are we? Like, someone just rebooted me. And I come back to and I wake up and there's literally AMED, you know, ambulance, what's the word I'm looking for? Paramedics all around me. And the girl right by my left foot, I graduated with, and she's bawling. She's crying like uncontrollably. Mind you, these guys see overdoses all day, every day. And so like I couldn't understand like why she was crying. I'm like, why is she crying? Like we used to be friends, and she didn't know me as she did when she was trying to revive me. She didn't know that version of me, and so I couldn't understand that. And she said to me, and I'll never forget it. She's like, you don't. She said, Brandon, you don't know how lucky you are. She said, we didn't have anything on you for 5 minutes. Like you were gone. Like you were gone. And at the time, like I heard it, but like it didn't like fully like register with me like the severity of like what just happened. And so they take me by ambulance to the hospital, and I get to the hospital and I'm sitting there, and somebody from Blair Drug and Alcohol was there, and it may or may not have been the guy that just introduced me. He almost had me, man. He was so close to getting me to rehab. I was sitting there and he was saying all the things, and like, you know, the desire, the flame was burning, just flickering just a little bit. But I waited till I agreed to go. I said, I'll go. So he goes, he's like, I'll be right back. Makes a call, and I get up. And the whole time this is happening, I'm feeling my pockets, and I realize I still have a bundle in my pocket. They didn't take it. And I'm like, go to rehab, or... So I get up when he walks away, and I run out of the hospital. I have grippy socks on. I don't even have shoes. So I'm running around with basketball shorts, a cutoff t-shirt, and grippy socks. I'm running across the bridge in Altoona. And I go to a place, I tell them, I have, because that's the only way they're letting me in, is if I have something to offer. I was like, yeah, I have something. Walk in with my grippy socks, I'm like, where have you been? I'm like, ah, don't worry about it. I use again, and I overdose again within a few hours, the second time. And ambulance comes, and they take me back to the hospital. And at this point, you know, I don't know if you've ever been in the hospital as an addict. An active addiction, they don't like you. they don't have time for your shit, you know. And it was very much the vibe in the room. And you know, I was mad, and like I wanted to get up and go again. But at this point, I'm starting to feel like really like hot and like uncomfortable. But I don't understand it, because like something's going on. So when they brought me back, they cracked my chest in half. They cracked my sternum in half doing CPR. And so like my chest was just like this, like saloon doors. And it was extremely painful. And I'm sitting there, and the doctor comes in and he says, listen, you're not going anywhere. I'm like, shit, the cops are coming. That was my first thing. I was like, the cops are coming. That was all I cared about. I was like, I don't wanna go to jail. He's like, you're not going anywhere. You're going to be, we're taking you up to the ICU. Apparently, I had a really, really bad staph infection in my bloodstream from, you know, using. And it traveled through my heart and got caught in a valve, and I got endocarditis. Long story short, I spent 2 months in the hospital, went to a nursing home thereafter. And mind you, through this whole experience, I've probably been in and out of probably 24 rehabs, and with maybe one successful completion. They were all AMAs. They were good ideas at first, and then I got there like, eh, not for me, and then I take off. And so I was like, this is it. Like, this is as bad as it gets. Like, it's crazy. I spent two months in the hospital, you know, it was enough to bring my mom back around. Like, she came into the hospital in tears, and I thought this woman hated me. and she started to kind of talk to me a little bit, and I agreed to go to rehab again, and I went and got out, and this is right at the beginning of COVID, and that PUA money hit, and like literally the day I got out, and I had all these grand plans. I'm like, I'm gonna get a car. You know, it was like $23,000 at once from being completely broke for months. And you know, I had none of the tools in rehab. Like I didn't, like I looked at the posters on the wall and saw the 12 steps. I'm like, that ain't for me, you know? And I would sit in CBT, I'm like, whatever. I was just there to go through the motions. And when I got out, I used again, I overdosed again. And then I got caught. I got caught with a lot. A lot, man, because like I had to support my habit, and I felt that like investing this money into, you know, copious amounts of, you know, fentanyl and like going down to Philly and getting this stuff, and you know, my friend asked me to watch her house while she went to Mexico for a wedding. I'm like, absolutely, I will do that for you, no problem. The intention was to just trap the shit out of her house. And I had people coming in through the front door, the back door, the side door. I had two, I thought I was the shit, man. I'm like, I got this shit humming. Like I had two phones, you know, like literally like Kevin Gates. I had two phones going. And you know, I'm in incognito mode because I don't want them to know, like, just crazy shit, man. And I'm sitting there, I'm talking like bricks, and I'm sitting here, and there's this bay window, and all I hear is a, you know, that knock. And I look behind me, there's no blinds in this bay window, so mind you, I'm doing all this shit on a couch with a giant coffee table with all my shit, like I'm like Tony Montana or something. And I just look behind me, and there they are. And apparently the girl's, the house that I was watching, her ex-boyfriend had a home plan there, and they were coming to do a well, or just to check, you know, check on him. And he wasn't there, but I was, with a lot of shit. And you know, so yeah. They took me, and I was in there for a little bit, you know, mind you, this is coming from a kid that went to church from the ages of birth to 18, you know, with morals and principles and values, and, you know, it says that this disease doesn't discriminate. It truly, like, I've seen lawyers and doctors in here, like, you know, that... It doesn't discriminate, man. And I had no priors, so I was fortunate enough, you know, I did some jail time. I was fortunate enough to get what they call drug court in Blair County anyways. 2 years of a program, got a piss for the government like five times a week. It's a lot. And part of the stipulation was that I had to go to rehab, which I was not. I was like, I'm good though, like, because at the time, like, I used that money. I did have a car. I wouldn't have had the car if I didn't get that PU money. Trust and believe that. I had a little place of my own, you know. So in my head, I'm like, I'm doing good. It's not just because like I got a quick lump sum of money. I got, like, I was gonna lose that very quickly. But I had to go to rehab, and I went to rehab, and I kind of was like, I'm experienced with this. I've done like 12 of them, and you know, I didn't successfully complete any of them. So I go in there, and you know, this is right at the beginning of COVID, like right at the very beginning, when people thought like this was like people were going to turn into zombies and eat each other. And not to take away, it was a pretty serious situation, but. I went in there and I started coughing like crazy. I'm like, I have COVID. Or like, we tested you. You don't have COVID. I'm like, no, I do. And I thought like that was it. They're gonna, you know, let me out on medical. And like, no, they didn't buy it. So I was like, I gotta do something here. Like the desperation of like panic and like that's still ingrained into me. And I remember it was a smoke break, and I went outside and I saw this nice little branch sticking out of the ground, and I'm like, that looks good enough to trip over. So like I walk over to a trip and I fall and I make a huge scene. Like I can't move, I can't do anything, I can't feel my legs. Ambulance comes in through the back, loads me up on a stretcher. takes me to the hospital, and obviously they're gonna see I did absolutely nothing to my back. So they're like, you're fine. Sent me back to rehab, and the next morning I walk in to the counselor's office, and my PO's on the phone, and she's like, Brandon, do that again, you're going like straight to prison. Like, there's no, like, you have this, or it's a 2-4, like, take your... So in that moment, I felt like my first little bit of acceptance, just a little bit, and a little bit of willingness, right? And I remember going through that, and they would break up meetings, you know, AA, NA, DRA, you know, all the A's, you'd be find whatever one you like. And I, you know, obviously I gravitated towards the little NA group meeting that they do. And they said in there, like, it's, they would say it at every rehab, it's wait until you get outside these walls, that's when the test comes. And so I had enough of an open mind to be like, all right, well, obviously, like, what I'm doing isn't working, you know. So I took the suggestion to go to a meeting, and I went to a meeting, and I remember being so scared to go in, because I'm like, I'm like a rare case, like, these guys can't handle me. Only to walk in to be like, oh shit, these are my people. Like, these people, like, it's crazy when somebody else shares, like, the identification of, like, me too, you know. That's what drew me close to the program, man, because I'm like, I didn't feel so alone, you know? I didn't feel so alone, and it brought me into this beautiful process of recovery. And, you know, I started taking the suggestions, like, get a home group, get a sponsor, be of service, you know, the common ones that they say. And, like, it didn't really click until, like, 2 months in. I was like, I guess I better, you know, get a home group. So I walk up and, hey, can I join your home group? You know, like, nervous, and, like, it's really just, can I join? Yeah, yes, you can join, you know, be of service. And first thing was to make coffee. And I'm, like, I'm making coffee, and I feel a part of something for the first time in ever. This is including childhood. For the first time ever, the act of me making coffee with a group of people who are just like me was a beautiful thing. And that lit the fire, the flame, you know, that we talked about. And I remember the first time going up to ask asked for a sponsor, and I went up, and, like, I've been listening for a while, and I'm like, I'm gonna find the right one, you know, because there's a lot of people that come up and talk very well, but then as soon as they walk out of the building, different person. And so, like, I wanted to identify that, because I know that I want to be me everywhere. Like, I want to be me when I'm in here, I want to be me when I'm out there. I want to have integrity. Like, these things I was looking for in a sponsor. And I remember finally asking my sponsor, working up the courage to do it. And I don't know why, like, for some reason it felt like I was on some quest to ask this wizard to guide me on this magical road, you know. And I, like, go up to him, and, like, for some reason in my head I feel like I'm real tiny. And, like, I go over and I'm like, excuse me, sir. And, like, just real awkward. Like, that's, I don't know why, like, I was so nervous and, like, tapped him like a weirdo. But, like, he's in the middle of conversation, like, having a full-blown conversation with somebody. I awkwardly interrupt and tap him. He looks behind me, looks at me, continues his conversation. I'm like, do I bail? Like, do I like leave now? I'm like, no, I worked up the courage, I'm gonna stand here. So I stayed there, finished his conversation, he turned back to me and he said, oh, you're still there? And that was the start of our relationship, man. And that was the best, one of the best times of, one of the best things I ever did for myself, man. Because I saw all the books, we have books for sale, IPs, take one, pass along, it could save your life or someone else's. I heard that all the time. And I thought it was just, you know, the rooms and the unity, and that is a giant part of this program. But where the healing starts is in the literature and the guidance with a sponsor. And man, I can tell you, because he set me off on assignments first, because it wasn't just, you know, hop into the first step, you know, it was like sponsorship IP, you know, and the little assignments. And I didn't realize what it was. Like, I wanted so bad to get to the first step, because I wanted to get to 12 real quick, you know, like that, that was the thing. I was like, I want to get to 12 by like the first 6 months. That was my idea coming into this, you know, and I can tell you that that's not the case. You know, in our sponsorship family, we kind of, he says we don't do drive-bys. You know, when we sit down, it is hours of conversation and back and forth and multiple sessions. Sometimes it can take a really long time to get through a step because I'll write on it and I've procrastinated. Don't get me wrong. Like, there's times I get home from work and I'm like, you know, I have my step work sitting there. I look at that, I look at the TV, and I'm like, yeah, we're Netflixing tonight. And then that goes on for like 2 weeks and it's still sitting there, you know? So I procrastinated, I put it off, but I found that like the solution is in this program. There's a saying that says like, willingness without action is fantasy, you know? So like, what am I willing to do? And am I gonna actually do it? You know, because I can be willing to do a lot of fucking things. I have been in the past. I'm gonna go to the gym every day and I'm gonna do this and I'm gonna eat right. I'm gonna restrict myself 1200 calories in a day. Willingness is there, the action is not. And it got me into the literature, man, and like working a first step, it's like so eye-opening. I remember just being in complete and total shock. You know, I start looking at the unmanageability of my life, the insanity, because I answered it in two different ways. I answered it in active addiction and then currently. Just because I'm not using drugs doesn't mean the disease of addiction isn't active. This disease is a son of a bitch. Brought me into a first step and allowed me to identify some things about myself. For the first time, really looking at who I am, because I just floated through, just kind of went through, and I had this idea made up by other people and situations of who I was. It wasn't until I got into the first step that I started to identify, oh, there's something going on here. And then, you know, going into a second and a third, I grew up in the church, so I thought God was just going to smite me immediately. I was not going to heaven. There's no way. You know, like I got evidence. And if he sees everything, he saw some shit. You know what I mean? And when do I have to shut up? What's the time? Drew, when do I have to stop? All right. Fair enough. You know, I went to church. It was every Sunday, every Sunday night, every Wednesday, sometimes on Fridays. There was Bible studies that I was an unwilling participant in. You're coming to Bible study. So-and-so is coming over. I want you to be there. Sitting in. And so, like, my idea of, because I heard higher power, and I instantly went to what I grew up with. You know, like, not a loving, caring, higher power, and of my own understanding. My own understanding, because my understanding for the longest time was my father's. It was what somebody else wanted, and it was such a, to realize that, to realize like, oh shit, of my own understanding, not like what this religion says or that religion says. I thought spirituality and religion were the same fucking thing. Turns out they're not. You find out a lot of things in this process. It is so beautiful, man. And I had an idea of what God was, you know, my higher power. And getting connected to that, And the second and third, and putting everything I have into that, and the trust, the hope, and the faith, and it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And it's a relationship I have. I talk to God every day. I talk to my higher power every day, without fail. Like sometimes people will say like, you know, pray in the morning, you know, gratitude, like write a list or do this or do that, and like, that might work for you, but it's of my own understanding. You know that voice in your head where you're just like, either you're eviscerating yourself because you did something weird, or like you didn't do something to your standard, that inner voice. You got the good voice and the bad voice, like the angel and the devil on the shoulder. Like, my conversations happen consistently throughout the day. You know, at first it was like the serenity prayer. You know, I would say that, I'd say that motherfucker all the time. And then it developed, right? Like, I started having conversations, you know, like, this is what's going on in my life, and like just praying for guidance and understanding. It's a beautiful thing. And then, you know, the importance for me, like working a really strong, thorough 1, 2, and 3 was so important, because 4 is next. You know, if you don't have a strong foundation underneath you, it's going to crumble. It's going to fall apart. And I've seen it happen to so many people. And that's why, like, I'm so grateful to have the sponsor and the people in my life that work the program that they do, because it is not, you know, they say it's a simple program for complicated people. We're definitely complicated. But it takes some work. You know, this is a process, you know, a restoration. It takes time. And I initially came in with a fire, and like, I'm getting to 12 real quick, you know, and I found that like quality over quantity is where it's at. You know, what's the quality of the information that I'm receiving? You know, because it's one thing to read a book, because like, I did that in rehab. I read the basic text, and I'm like, all right, I'm like ready to go. Like, I'm good. I read it. Turns out I didn't understand a fucking word in the book. You know, it's one thing to read something. It's one thing to take it in intellectually, but it's another thing to practice, to internalize something, right? Like, people would always say principles over personalities. Like, when somebody's acting out of pocket, they're like, well, principles over personalities. Well, what principles? Like, what are we talking about here? You know, we can trust that people will be people. We're addicts at the end of the day. And, you know, I'm just really grateful to be a part of this process. It talks about a fundamental transformation. And, you know, when I say some of these things, like, my sponsees and people in my sponsorship family are like, I don't see how you did any of those things. Like, I don't see that. And that's the confirmation. That's how I know that there has been a fundamental change. And we were talking about spiritual awakenings on the way up. And sometimes they come in spurts. You know, those aha moments, like, oh, that's what that means. Like, this is working, you know? Being honest in a place you were never honest in before, because we still do that now clean. We're still dishonest. I'm still dishonest. I still fall short, you know? And this is a process, and as long as I'm willing to be a participant in it, have an open mind, and remain teachable, because, you know, you get to a certain point, you get like, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years, and you're like, all right, nobody can tell me shit. I know some things. Turns out I'm wrong on a lot of things, man. You know, you get around some old timers, and they put you right in your fucking place, tail right between your legs, and it's like, all right. But I need that. I need those people around me. I need people to be honest and not put a cut on it. I need people to hurt my feelings, you know? Not intentionally, but like, I'm trying to save my life. I have evidence of what happens whenever I don't. When I'm not in this process, I have an abundance of evidence that shows me the bitter ends, jails, institutions, or death. And I have no desire for that. I can tell you on my way up here, just real quickly, at work, there was an employee that came in. I work in a car dealership, and there was an employee that came in, and she was all over the place. On wild tangents, talking about why people need to learn how to play chess, like, you know, the types of conversations, and getting everybody a chess book and laying them. She doesn't even work that day. She came in, and the owner calls me and says, Brandon, I need your help. What an honor. You know, I lost that yesterday. Somebody I sponsored for a short period of time committed suicide, and I was at a funeral for him, and I was really in a bad place. I was really in a bad place. And like, God is amazing, man. He puts things in your path that set you straight, man. And like, it's so beautiful. There was this girl that came in, and she was acting crazy. And the owner of multiple dealerships, you know, asked me to help. And I was able to pull her in and have a conversation with the owner, and you know, it was productive, and we got to a place. But you know, the feeling when someone is not willing and they are stuck in denial and delusion, and that's where it ended. And I said, listen, just go home and call me if you need anything. I said, I don't want you to think, I'm not going to tell anybody what you tell me. Anonymity is so important to me. I said, but so is honesty. I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you because somebody told me. And she went home, and I went to the meeting last night, and I texted her, and I said, how are you feeling? And she knows I work a program, and she's handy with ChatGPT, so she mentioned open-mindedness and willingness, and she was really trying to lay on the justification, everything. And I said, listen, I love you. If you need anything tonight, please call me. And I'm on my way up here today, and right before I walk in the building, the owner calls me, and she's like really worked up, and she said, you have 2 seconds, I know you're speak. She knows how important this program is to me. She said, I know you're about to speak, but she came in, and I just feel like I didn't do enough. She came back into the dealership today and was on the decline of a meth bender, on a downward spiral, and she came in, she was all over the place, and I told her what to do when that happens is just, you know, talk to her and get her to a safe place. And she got in her car and she drove, and she totaled her car with her kid in it. I don't know if little Nick is okay. I don't know much about it right now, but I do know they took her away in handcuffs, and she was spitting on the police officers. This is not the girl I've known for 2 years. This is a girl that worked a job and came in early every day and was there and was consistent, and in an instant, just one, took it away. You know, like she will probably never have her kid again. And I was able to be there for when the owner called me in tears, saying, what do I do? What did I do wrong? I said, you did nothing wrong, you know? And she said, I just want you to know that I love you, and I feel like I understand you better now. And I don't know, man. I do know. This is the place, you know? This place has changed my life, and I'm going to say what most people say when they get up here. It has changed my life beyond my wildest dreams. And I used to see that and be like, they're lying. They're lying. It's true. You know, all of the things that I lost, the homelessness, like I own a home. I have the material things. Brand new truck. I never thought I was going to drive a new truck, and I got a new truck. I'm like, recovery gave me this shit. A Harley, like just cool material gadget things. But like, that's not like in comparison to the relationships I got back. My mom called me 3 times today. 3 times. My mom wouldn't talk to me for 3 months at a time. And my nephew called me today. My sister and my brother were planning something to surprise my mother for Mother's Day tomorrow. This is what the program has afforded me, a life worth living. And I can tell you what we have here is like the suggestion to just keep coming back. That's all I have. Thanks, guys.